tonight I'm going to speak about some things that you're familiar with and some things you're not familiar with. We're going to talk about food in terms of ethics, food in terms of land, food in terms of cooking, as well as food in terms of consciousness. And it's that latter point that I want to emphasize, because no doubt more and more people are becoming aware that we're eating not by the grace of industry, but by the grace of nature. But when we turn to the ancient yoga texts associated with India, we find that when we say we're eating by the grace of nature, we need to be more specific. Nature includes consciousness. The yoga texts will teach us that according to the consciousness of the person cooking the food, that determines an effect on the consciousness of the eater. So it's not simply that you are what you eat. It's that you're picking up through eating the consciousness of the cook. So therefore, cooking in yoga has a very prominent place. Even now, looking at Indian cultural tradition, you'll find the statement that the happiness of Indian family life is eating. Meaning that the meal is not just about nutrients, physical stuff like that, biochemical stuff like that. It's about the partaking of higher consciousness. So tonight, of course, we're not going to be talking about any particular ethnic tradition. We're going to be looking for universal principles based on consciousness as a non-material reality. Now, if you're a neoclassical neuroscientist, you won't even talk about consciousness. It doesn't exist because it doesn't manifest in any way that can be measured or quantified by science as we know it now. In fact, I like to point out my travels around the world, there's not one scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. The yoga texts are presenting to you a way of distilling and purifying consciousness, so much so that when a high consciousness person prepares food, it will affect the consciousness of others in a very powerful way. But the converse is also true, that if someone of unfortunately low consciousness prepares food and you take it, your consciousness becomes surcharged with the baser instincts of existence. Some people don't mind that. Others, they want to aim their life to higher levels. When we speak about nature, then, I want you to please include consciousness. Or, if you want to divide nature, you can do it as the ancient yogic text Bhagavad Gita does. The inferior nature and the superior nature. The inferior nature being matter, and the superior nature being conscious living entities. So, the yogis understand that what distinguishes the inferior nature from the superior nature is the possession of consciousness. This microphone stand is not conscious, but living entities to varying degrees are conscious. The difference of degree depends on the body. In other words, different types of bodies allow the different manifestation of consciousness. When you were a little tiny kid, it's not that you didn't have consciousness, but the child's body didn't allow the full manifestation of consciousness that is there when you are an adult. So that's something to bear in mind. We don't want to get too deeply into that today, the relationship between consciousness and the body. We want to focus on the relationship between consciousness and food. Everyone is interested in food. Everyone likes to eat good food. But what are the effects of good food on simply more than our tongue and our belly? Is it that we simply get a warm feeling in our belly when things are nicely spiced? Or is there a question of consciousness upliftment? Indeed, can we express the highest and purest love through cooking? Can you eat the experience of pure love? These are questions that are at the heart of the ancient yogic texts. So let's talk about sustenance just briefly. Sustenance in terms of getting food has always been humanity's most persistent and direct link to the land. If you look back in history, you see that, let's go back to Queen Victoria's time in England. She knew very little in terms of the origin of the food on her table, because it was coming from all over Britain's massive empire. That was opulence and royalty back then. Now, the average person today in the USA has that same separation or disconnection from the origin of food. We're disconnected from the land that grows the food, and we're even, as many of you know, disconnected from the cooking process of the food. Not many people today cook every day. They want to go to a fast food place, and that takes care of that. So you have a very pervasive disconnection in terms of how food is grown and how food is prepared. These physical facts are known, but what about the role of consciousness? Because if we're going to deal with uplifting people, if we're going to deal with uplifting ourselves, we need to grasp the role of consciousness in relation to eating. Those of you who are aware of the environmental debate, I have to be aware of that because the country I'm based in, New Zealand, is rated by the UN as being the most ecologically conscious country in the world. If anyone here is from Sweden, well, Sweden's number two. So, USA doesn't do too well on that list, unfortunately. But I'm sure you all will change that. Now, the first Earth Day celebrations in the USA focused on population growth, industrial pollution, and endangered species. I can remember back in my university days, you know, the first environmental activism. In fact, the present dean of the oldest environmental school in the U.S., the Yale School of Environment and Forestry, he was an activist as a Yale student back in the 70s, late 60s. And I remember persons of that group. They would talk about saving the environment and the coming environmental crisis while munching on Big Macs and, you know, drinking lots of coffee. And they never thought that the Big Macs are coming from corn-fed beef, from cows, increasingly kept in confined feeding operations. And they never thought that their coffee that they're drinking huge amounts of comes from monoculture in Brazil. So things have changed a lot since that time. And many of you know how food has moved closer to the center of environmentalism. So much so that in the year 2006, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization astounded everyone by saying that the livestock sector plays a greater role in greenhouse gas emissions than transport. Well, this was quite a wake-up call that the way people are eating has profound implications. Let me just back up a bit and look at this situation from another angle, rather than just the environmentalism as we know it, or cooking as we know it. I'd like to talk about the ethics of food, because ethics involves conscious beings. You don't expect, this bottle holding the water to have an ethical relationship with this cup here. But you do expect ethics amongst developed conscious beings. You don't even expect ethics amongst cats and dogs or giraffes or fish. Whether you believe those creatures have consciousness or not, you don't expect ethical dealings among them. But you do expect ethical dealings amongst human beings. So briefly speaking, ethics started out about how to live a good life. I was talking to my new acquaintance here, and she was explaining to me, I just want to live a happy and, enjoyable life. And that's a classical expression of ethics from antiquity. How do you live a good life? What's a good life? From there, the definition of ethics became involved with charity towards other human beings, friendship. Now, we have the hot issue of food ethics. Our relationship to the source of food and our relationship with how the food is prepared. This is a subject that only conscious beings can deal with. So rather than just push consciousness out of the picture in terms of our cooking, why don't we just focus on it directly? It's not simply that the ethics of food involves, we should be careful, for example, about industrial agriculture because synthetic nitrogen fertilizer gives off something called nitrous oxide. Scientists have known that this nitrous oxide released from synthetic fertilizer, it gets into the atmosphere and has an effect of 300 times more heat trapping power than carbon. So there was always a peacefulness that it's only 1% of the nitrogen fertilizer that does it. Suddenly, though, the International Council for Science has put out the data that the statistic is actually minimum 4% and probably 5%. So this becomes a worry. How am I eating in such a way that I'm affecting future generations? I like to point out that we have this idea that I've inherited the world from my parents and grandparents, when actually we should be thinking that we're borrowing the world from our children and grandchildren. So this is ethics. This is a shift in consciousness. So if indeed consciousness is so important, what are we without consciousness, even though we don't know what it is? Of course, science. The ancient yoga texts fully elaborate on what is consciousness, both in terms of finite consciousness as well as infinite consciousness. That's what the yoga system is really aiming for. the connection between the finite consciousness and the infinite consciousness. In contemporary parlance, that's known as Krishna consciousness. Krishna in Sanskrit means the unlimited reservoir of conscious pleasure. So, our focus upon the land and food has to take into account consciousness and the ethics of eating. Let's look at what's happening today. In, let's say, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, if you were a low-income person, you would just forage off the land and whatever's around you. According to your limited means, you would scrape by on whatever's around you. And the wealthy would get their food resources from all over the world. Fancy food from here and there, this continent, that continent. Now, actually, things are becoming the reverse. If you're of low income, you must just, you simply must buy processed food from far off. And if you're well off, you can afford the locally grown food at the Whole Foods Market. We'll just see how things have reversed. So an ethical, conscious person thinks of these things, especially since statistics show that no more than 3% of the food consumed in the USA is grown under ecologically sustainable conditions. Oh, yes, we need to think about that. What can we do that will make a powerful change besides any environmental or food activism, besides campaigning for everyone to have access to locally grown food? I'd like to put forth a concept that's not as radical or esoteric as it may sound. It's something that has been known for millennia to yogis, but now it's approaching mainstream. That is something called food with embedded intentions. That's the latest lingo. Embedded intentions. That means preparing food and consciously embedding good intentions into the food. Let's give some examples from commerce. As one American president said in the 20th century, the business of the USA is business. So if we give you examples from the business world, perhaps you'll consider that this food with embedded intentions isn't such a wacky idea at all. Of course, a big part of what Pandit is doing in his cooking classes is actually embedding the... I hope I'm not revealing your secrets. He's embedding the food with high order consciousness to the best of his ability. It's, the food is tasty, of course, and you'll learn how to prepare tasty food, but he has an agenda of higher consciousness. So, for example, let's look at, yes, it's from California. What is it? The mixture varies in what I've heard, but California is 40% fruit and 60% nuts. So is it? Anyway, no. I said I heard it. I didn't say it. So, there's a water company called H2OM. It is selling water infused with wishes for love, joy, and perfect health. Oh, God, you're laughing, okay. But no, this is business. So, Supposedly, and I'm just saying this in a value-free way, supposedly by the labels on the water bottles, the labels have certain patterns and colors that give a certain specific vibratory frequency so that when you drink the water, you you feel good. Okay. Another example, this is a Canadian firm called Creo Mundi. They make protein powder. Seems to be a pretty bland and boring thing, protein powder. So, before each shipment of Creo Mundi protein powder, the employees gather around the big container, freight container, and they state aloud their the benefits they hope the consumers will get. Increased performance, better vitality. So they're embedding the protein powder, as they see, with their intentions. Now this is business. I mean, you're laughing, but some of you, I'm sure, will be heading into the world of business, and things are going on, Any chocolate lovers here? Yes. Chocolate addicts, I should say, right? Well, think about this. There's a company called Intentional Chocolate. And it uses a special recording device to capture the electromagnetic brain waves of meditating Tibetan monks. And then when the chocolate is being made, it's exposed to this recording of brainwaves for 5 days per batch. Well, you're laughing, but I'm laughing too. But there's something to this concept, but I don't know if the examples I've given here actually get the job done. Now, just to perk you up a bit, there's a scientist. He's an alternative scientist, not by credentials, is he deemed an alternate scientist, but he's deemed an alternate scientist according to the fields that he's researching. Some of you may have read some of his books, Dean Radin. He's actually conducted a legitimately authentic scientific experiment, which says, as its results, those who eat intentional chocolate improve their mood 67% compared to those who eat regular chocolate. He says there's a small effect that's gained by eating chocolate with embedded intentions. I'm giving you these examples to show that this concept, long known to yogis, is starting to make its way to the edges of the mainstream. What is not completely realized yet by these business outfits is the role of consciousness and the depths of consciousness and the science of consciousness, particularly. Is there just finite consciousness, limited consciousness? Or is there also unlimited consciousness? Bhakti yoga, I know that some of you here are in the Bhakti club. Bhakti yoga means the science of the relationship between the individual finite consciousness and the supreme unlimited consciousness. Again, in contemporary parlance, that's called Krishna consciousness. Obviously, there are some skeptics. What would the world be without skeptics? So, I know one professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the University of California, James Fallon. He told me, look, this is nuts. Are you trying to tell me I take a cucumber and I put it close to my head and somehow the cucumber changes and when someone eats that cucumber, the mood of the person changes? I said, no way I'm believing this. So, is a controversy, except in the world of yoga and meditation. Because in the world of yoga and meditation, consciousness is understood as the major player on the stage. The principle is that if you eat food cooked by a person with refined consciousness, that the eater will be influenced, will be tinged by the consciousness of the cook. So in the Bhakti Yoga texts, the whole technique is to offer the food with, first, to prepare the food with love and devotion for the Supreme Consciousness. The texts say Krishna. And then that food becomes spiritualized due to the devotion of the cook, due to the high consciousness of the cook. And then when the food is eaten, you get a spiritual surcharge. So that's, again, I hope I'm not revealing your secrets, but that's why the food here tastes a bit different, you know, even though it seems to be ordinary ingredients. I told you about the embedded intentions just to perk your ears up a bit, that it's not such a far-out concept. In fact, the New York Times reported that, well, in today's economy, things are so bad, hey, you better jump on any horse that rides. Maybe embedded foods, is it? If we can produce a profit, so let it be. But then we have to point out that as soon as the profit motive is mixed in with your embedded intentions, things don't really fly. So this is the problem. When the food is prepared